Hello and welcome to another edition of To FinTech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe. I'm Alex Reddish and joining us this week is Tasha Chauhan, UK and Ireland Banking Sales Director at Tink. Today we're going to ask the question, is open banking calamitous without corporates? Hello and welcome to another episode of To FinTech and Beyond. My name is Alex Reddish, the Managing Director of Tribe Payments, and today I'm here with Tash Chauhan from Tink. Tash, I will just congratulate you on promotion and allow you to introduce yourself and a bit of your background.
Great. Thank you, Alex, and thank you for having me. So my role at Tink, I'm UK and Ireland Banking Director. So that means I run the banking business for Tink in the region. What that means is things like go-to-market, what we're doing with customers, both clients and prospects, but then more broadly looking at what we're doing from a content perspective, research that we're running, being a bit more specific in the UK market. I've been at Tink for 2 and a bit years now. Prior to that, I was at Starling Bank, where I was heading up the business development team for banking services. So that's the banking as a service platform within Starling. So faster payments, virtual accounts, that kind of stuff. And then prior to that, I've got a background in payments, working at Fiserv and also Dovetail.
Awesome. So I think focusing on the current role at Tink, we're going to hear talk today about open banking. Just in terms of scene setting today, it'd be great to hear your opinion on what the landscape looks like today, you know, where we're at, why we're here, and you know, what we've been through to get here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think open banking's been on a massive journey up until this point. More recently, there's been, I think it was a couple of months ago now, OBIE released the figures that there's 6 million users in the UK market, which is great. That's 10% of the UK population. But it's taken us a number of years to get to this point. The reason for that, the reason why it's taken so long, it's down to the mandate, of course, getting the bank APIs to a certain point, but then also the TPPs being able to actually take the data and the data access and initiating payments and getting it to a standard where it's actually fit for purpose for consumers and businesses. There's a lot of focus on that around what the customer experience is. And a user, whether it's a consumer or a business, they're not going to use open banking unless it's delivering some value of some sort. It needs to be quicker, needs to be cheaper, needs to be generally easier to use. And that's what's going to shift consumer behavior. But we're getting to the point now where we're becoming a lot more mature in that. And you can see really great propositions being released. I think one of the interesting things from Tink specifically is how we look at like open banking more generally, not just UK open banking, but actually like the umbrella term of it, which is around data access. And that's not just looking at payment accounts, that's looking at everything else in there as well. It's the movement of data between third parties.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of interesting points in there, isn't it? I think everyone always associates open banking with effectively two use cases, aggregation of balance or payment initiation, whereas actually all you're doing is aggregating data, and therefore that the data point that is being aggregated is fundamentally interchangeable. You talked a lot about focus on consumer experience, or ultimately the drive for a user, corporate or consumer, to change. Do you think that's some of the learnings we've had out of the early years, like not just product building, but actually focusing on the end customer experience?
Yeah, definitely. And I actually think, like, to the point that you just made there about seeing it as aggregation and payment initiation, we've moved on from that. Even Tink as a business has moved on from that. We've had skin in the game now for over 10 years, and we used to see it as just connectivity and then data enrichment, but actually it's one step further than that now. It's looking at the specific use cases of which you're able to actually add value to that, whether it's a case of being able to help users with money management and really engage on the way in which you're interacting with them, or whether it's looking at loan originations and looking at how you can help lending decisions with a data-driven approach. It's now being a lot more specific in what you're doing as opposed to just access to stuff.
I think you've kind of preempted my next question a bit, but in terms of, therefore, some of the interesting things we're seeing in open banking, can you give us an indication of what is not normal but exciting in this space at the moment?
The first use case you mentioned, the multi-banking use case, that was short-lived. That was very short-lived. I mean, a couple of years ago, you saw a couple of banks introduce it, but it's a case of, again, like, what's that value exchange? Okay, you can see your transactions from another bank, but what are you then doing with that? Okay, a user can look at their holistic finances, but what's the next step then? Can you help them transfer money in between those accounts? Can they set up budgets against certain payment types? There's certain features and functionality that could take that one step further, and that didn't happen. So now it is a case of, okay, how can you refine the data through data access and then use that for other purposes, like loan origination, so that in terms of financial inclusion, you can give access, you can give credit to individuals or businesses that typically wouldn't be able to access that. We launched some research a couple of months ago around the self-employed. And it's shocking, the stats there, because they are unable to account for a lot of what they can actually get access to. But open banking is actually helping that, because you can fetch a full transaction history and be able to refine that to understand affordability of an individual.
Kind of that democratization of data so that it becomes the underlying persons rather than the institutions. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? Especially if you think about us as individuals now, we're much more data savvy, data conscious. I think being able to move that around to suit our needs, whether that's convenience or privacy, is very important. Do you see much change or variance in between consumer and corporate propositions? Like, are you seeing much variance? Obviously self-employed, but are you seeing many exciting things around the corporate space?
No, and I think this is one of the areas which I think in the coming months/years we'll definitely see a lot of progress in this space. The challenge that we've had up until this point is that actually the data access in those types of areas, it's not easy. It's really not. And you need to incentivize the institutions that have access to that data in order to make it accessible for everybody else, so that you can then do additional things with that data, like we're doing with consumer data at the moment.
And it comes back to that also, like, the demand for change, isn't it? I think one of the interesting things you sort of said in the introduction was about driving consumer behavior, and therefore you're having to add value to warrant that change. Like, there's obviously a multitude of ways you can make a payment or do different things. Like, how do you add that value? I think that corporate piece is still being defined, right? How do you add value in the corporate space with data and payment initiation, whatever?
I think it's also, like, with corporates and institutions, I mean, it's a different kettle of fish, right? Individuals, it's very easy to obtain consent for access to data. Whereas when you're talking about corporates, there's going to be multiple people that have that authority to give that consent and to authorise. So it becomes a lot more complex what you're trying to do in that space. And I think that's another area that we need to focus on as well.
It becomes that, like, this is a very separate podcast almost around digital identity. How do you replicate digital identity for consumer versus corporate, right? How do you onboard it? It's an interesting conversation around EID wallets at the moment. How do you, you know, manage your digital self? Hi, it's Alex here, and just a quick word from me to promote our brand new report, Solving the Post-Pandemic's Payment Puzzle: How Can Merchants and Acquirers Satisfy Consumer Demand? Based on a survey of 400 merchants across 5 key European markets, the aim of this research is to understand what payments issues and initiatives merchants are focused on as they resolve to meet consumer demand. We also dive into areas where merchants are seeking support and how payment partners and their acquirers can help. Head over to our website, trypayments.com, where you can download it for free. We've always looked at payments or this sort of Oyster card moment when we saw contactless really come into prevalence and sort of ubiquitous use. Do you think there will be an Oyster card moment for open banking? Is that something that you think is in play for this sort of product?
I think there has actually already been Oyster card moments in open banking, particularly with some cases that were seen in the UK market, like HMRC and their use of open banking. But then also NatWest and their internal build for payment initiation with PayIt. I think they reached 1 billion transactions the other week. So there's been quite a few moments already, particularly for us at Tink. We've had an Oyster card moment with one of our partners, Kivra. So they're a bill payment in Sweden. So Swedes will use Kivra to make payments like council tax, pay their rent, that kind of stuff. And it's Tink's payment initiation, which is embedded within that bill payment. So we're processing all of that for Kivra. I think it's the majority of the population using it. But in terms of the Kivra volumes that we're processing for payment initiation, that's more than UK open banking payment initiation as a whole, as a market. And we're doing that with one customer.
Wow. So do you think that comes from, because you think of like some of the Nordics and their sort of ID structures, digital IDs, like it comes from just an acceptance of this sort of payment type, or do you think it's because of the overlaying product and therefore the use case. Like, it's more about value, and the payment ultimately is an irrelevance in this. It's just a simplistic way of doing it. Like, why do you think open banking works for it?
I think it's both of them, right? It's a combination of the two. They've been a lot more advanced in certain areas, particularly in finance. Like, we're seeing some of the Nordic markets are cashless. So they're a lot more advanced than what we are in the UK. But then it's also about, I keep going back to the same point, but it's also about the customer journey and how that's built. One of the key things with the examples that I gave around HMRC, NatWest, PayIt, and Kivra, it's all about removing the friction from that. And removing that friction means that a consumer or a business, whoever the end user is more likely to reuse that service. And that's what's going to drive the volume. That's what's going to drive the adoption. Whether it's quicker, easier, cheaper, that's going to be the key thing. And removing that friction is the most important thing. And we're seeing it in the UK market with open banking. So you have the 90-day reconsents. We're working on some bits with One SCA, for example, taking it that next step so that we can do our bit to drive the adoption of that.
Building on that sort of 90-day mandate, stuff like that, like, do you think there is an opportunity for growth in standardization? Or, like, obviously we at the moment in the UK have different considerations to other parts of the world. Like, how does open banking become interoperable? Like, that feels like success waiting to happen in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to get open banking right to begin with first in terms of where we're at today. There's still work that needs to be done with open banking. I'm using the general term of, like, the umbrella term of open banking, data access. I'm not talking about UK open banking specifically. I do think that there is work that we can do in that space. But more generally, like, open banking, we need to get access to all data, not just payment account data. And once we do that, then we can start thinking about, okay, how do you make it interoperable between different markets? And I think payments is going to be the thing that really drives that.
Yeah, that it certainly builds trust with the consumer, right? That then you might give them your electricity data or whatever that may be.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, it's all down to the value exchange there. It's if you're able to build a really smart experience, then you're gonna, as an individual, as you would, like, if you see the value at the end of it, of course you're gonna give your consent to it. And I think it's like building these propositions. It's not just about payments. It's about, okay, what's the full end-to-end experience look like? What do we need to rope into this?
I was out the other day, I was trying to load my Revolut card through their open banking proposition by NatWest. But what I found was that because my bank account is in Alexander James and my Revolut is Alex Reddish, they were starting to reject, like, this created this friction. I was like, I understand this payments sort of proposition. And I think a consumer would just blow off, sod it, I'm not going to use it anymore if it's easier to use an Apple Pay or something like that, right? So this sort of interoperability, I think, stands at both corporate level as well as market level, just to make sure you get one shot ultimately, giving that consumer a chance to enjoy it, I think.
And if you get that one shot wrong, then it's a case of they might not be open to using it. So, like, some of the, like, there's different ways that open banking can be used. I mentioned loan originations. We've got a history of consumer engagement with PFM, but it's also things like onboarding and payment initiation, payment services as a whole. And if you don't show the value to the consumer and you give that, you lose that one shot, then you're probably going to lose out on the other experiences as well.
What are the risks to its growth? Like, is it fraud? Is it what, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, like, what is it? What are the risks that we need to be aware of if it's going to be successful, or if it becomes more successful, I should say?
Some of it will be down to, like, over engineering the process. So, to the extent, I mean, going back to the, like, terminology of open banking being, like, data exchange, we're seeing in the UK, for example, like everyone's talking about embedded finance, everyone's talking about open finance, and we're talking about OBIE and what happens with JROC now. And I feel that what we're doing in the market at the moment is trying to over-engineer the process, and it's almost going to stop us from being able to accelerate and go at pace into these types of spaces and actually be innovative in the different experiences that you can deliver to an end user. So I feel that that's going to slow us down a lot.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Like, I think it's a, symbolic of fintech to some extent. Like we were all agile, and then all of a sudden we're trying to solve 15,000 different problems at once, and actually you don't solve any of them. But yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I think because I think from my perspective, certainly, you know, like we have to disclose we work with you guys, right? But I think the thing that we're trying to find now is about, you know, how do you move beyond a compliance proposition and therefore demonstrate that value, but demonstrate the value to the client of Tribes rather than the end user. And I think there's still a lot of education. Like everyone sees the Anne Boland comments at the back end of last year, or everyone sees 1,500 articles about how complicated open banking is and how it's not been successful. I'm like, oh, sod it, I'll try something else. Whereas actually the fundamentals are there, right? It just needs someone smart and to apply that principle of what we've talked about earlier in terms of data and not looking at it as just a bank account, you know, data feed.
But this is it. It's more than just that. And I think like comments and statements that are made previously, like that can slow things down massively as a market. And we're focusing on things that we're not focusing on the future of what it can be. We're actually just caught up in people's opinions. And it's actually like open banking shouldn't mean anything to the everyday consumer or everyday business. It's not about that. It's never been about that. It's been about driving competition, making better experiences, more personalized, tailored offerings. And that's what we should be focusing on.
A consumer doesn't care, right? They just want the best outcome.
Yeah, and they shouldn't care. Why should they care? Like, my mum doesn't get open banking, and so she shouldn't. Like, it's not her world. But if she can get a personalised loan that is suited to her because of her expenditure, that makes more sense.
You need to up your dinner table chat if she doesn't understand it. As your mum. We'll work on that another time. It's worth mentioning to our listeners, given the topic, that we caught up with another open banking expert, Jim Wadsworth, in our fourth episode for a more general look at open banking and what's next for it. We covered aspects such as the differences in regulatory and innovation-driven markets, and we also explored the current global state of play, including what's happening in Europe, the States, and Brazil. So if you've just stumbled upon our podcast, because this is about open banking, make sure you check out that earlier episode in our podcast feed. Looking outwards to the future, like what do you see as coming down the line? I don't know if you're able to talk about what Tink, you know, Visa, what has planned for it, but like what does the next 12, 24, 36 months look like for open banking?
Open banking, I think in the next 12, 24, 36, I mean, 36 is, that's a long time, right, to be predicting on. Let's start with the 12. At the moment, it's integrating, as you know, we're recording this whilst I'm sat at the Visa offices. It's exciting being part of Visa. Whilst we're still independent, it's really exciting for Tink because it means that we're able to really understand like how we can expand beyond where we're at today. So we're leading in Europe, we're in 18 markets, but we've always had global aspirations. And being a Visa solution now means that we're able to like tap into the expertise and the know-how and how to get there and how to do that. And that's not just from a coverage perspective. So talking about connectivity, whether it be payment initiation or account aggregation, but it's actually looking at, okay, look at the products that we're producing, we're creating, and how can we differentiate them? How can we take it one step further than what we can do today, just being an open banking provider? And that's the differentiator. We have now one of the largest corporates, global corporates behind us, who's able to share that with us. And we've got some, Visa have got some real smart people at the table now helping us with that. So the next 12 months for Tink are really exciting for sure.
We've just expanded into Latin America and soon to be the US. And I think the thing that we found is around how we provide ubiquitous product offering. Like, so when we take just cards, right, we work with Visa, work with other schemes, but how do you provide the layers on top that add value? So how do you provide the open banking piece? How do you provide access to RTP, or, you know, how do you connect into Preto in Mexico? Like, all of these little nuances, I think, is where open banking can kind of become that umbrella. Like, no one needs to the point of your mum doesn't need to care about open banking. I shouldn't care about the payment rails, right? I should just have a relationship with a payment provider that allows me to move money interregionally, irrespective of payment type, currency, or settlement time frame. I think that's an interesting, exciting thing for you guys as being part of the Visa organisation.
No, absolutely. And Visa is more than just a card rail, right? There's more to it than that. They're huge. And I'm learning more and more every day in terms of what they're able to do. So it's really a case of, for us, being able to understand, like, firstly, what's the real value that we can bring to the market quickly for consumers and businesses. So looking at things like variable recurring payments, and how can we, as an open banking product, kind of take that and run with it and accelerate it so that it's different to what we're seeing with just like sweeping, but like commercial VRPs. Like, what's the differentiator that we can bring with Visa?
I think VRP specifically has a real opportunity if it evolves properly, just as kill direct debit, right? Like, direct debit is, in theory, a very old, you don't have to comment on that. I appreciate you possibly can't comment on that. But like, my view ultimately is that, you know, a 3-day settlement cycle is relatively expensive, and ultimately it's just undynamic. Like, it just doesn't suit today's digital economy, right? But I won't ask you to comment on that because I'm sure you'll decline.
I was just going to say, on VRP though, I think the interesting thing there is, like, we talked about the Oyster card moment before, and I think VRP, commercial VRP, that's going to be the Oyster card moment for open banking as a whole, not just an individual business, not just a use case type, but it's actually going to be the thing which we see, like, the hockey stick growth, because it's going to be a case of looking at recurring payments generally, and recurring payments can be anything. It's not just the sweeping me to me. It's actually looking at utility payments, like all of your subscriptions. To an extent, your Amazon purchases could be seen as a commercial VRP payment because it's a recurring payment. So long as you're setting up those thresholds of which the transaction value will sit between, that could be a commercial VRP payment. So it's super interesting where we could go with this.
You think that's an Oyster card moment because of its multitude of use cases?
Absolutely. And I think, thinking about what the traditional methods are today, so looking at card rails and looking at the cost there, and what VRP, like card on file, for example, commercial VRP could in essence replace some of that as well. So there's a massive cost saving there. And I think that's going to be one of the key things driving this, as well as, of course, the customer experience.
You said there's a few things we could do in the UK earlier. Like, are you able to elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what are the things that the ecosystem could be doing better?
As industry participants, I would say, there's a couple of things that I think could improve what we're doing with open banking. There's certain things like the type of access that you get with accounts. We talked about this earlier around UK open banking being just payment accounts, but that's a limitation in itself because it's not mandated for savings accounts or credit cards. So, for example, your Tesco credit card couldn't be aggregated in. All of those types of accounts, that will provide a better view and a better experience for customers. I think the other side to that as well, not the other side of it, but another point to that is also the open data economy. So just mandating dedicated interfaces and APIs specifically for this so that you can enrich experiences further. And it's that more holistic view.
Do you think it will by de facto therefore require an extension of regulation to really grow?
I think an extension of regulation is, it's a harsh way to put it, because I feel that the open banking mandate initially was not taken well because it's work that you have to do, not that you want to do. And I feel like regulation is, again, another harsh way of framing it. But in order to move to an open data economy, we need to, I guess, mandate some in essence, that bank APIs, they need to be able to access all data. You need to incentivize the banks in order to do it, because otherwise they're not going to do it of a good standard, good quality. But also that's going to have a knock-on effect to the types of experiences that you can derive from that data access as well. So we need to work better as a market in order to drive this new way of thinking.
To use your phrase earlier around value exchange, it's very difficult to incentivize a TPP or a pseudo TPP in a credit card company or one that could be to divulge this information unless there's a value exchange for them. So the mandate ultimately has to provide that. But I think what we saw with the mandate last time is then everyone did everything to comply rather than innovate. And so how do you actually create an environment that fosters innovation rather than fosters compliance?
This is what the crux of it is. It's like you need to incentivize, right? And in order to incentivize, there needs to be a good model in place so that we're able to actually deliver on this. Because you're not going to do, if you look at the UK market in comparison to Southern Europe, for example, with regards to the PSD2 implementations, there hasn't been any real enforcement of that. Obviously, we had OBIE, but in Southern Europe, there wasn't that. And if you look at the customer journeys, if you look at the flows in order to authenticate with a bank, it's painful. It's like 14 screens. It's really, really painful. That's not going to attract any customers. That's not going to drive any adoption. So I think you need to find the fine balance with it.
I don't know why we've always focused on consumer experiences, but why corporates have an opportunity, right? Like operational efficiency, all of this stuff. Like there's big opportunity within multi-corporates for open banking around data sharing and value. It just seems like we've always, rightly or wrongly, my perception is that open banking has always been consumer-led first and corporate second. But maybe that will change as we focus on that a bit more.
We're now getting to the point with consumer experiences that they're maturing. We're not at the pinnacle of it, but they're maturing. But we're now at the state of play where it's a case of we can look at the different segments out there. We can look at business banking. How do we serve SMEs better? And then we're looking at the different experiences, the different use cases that are real differentiators there. And it's a case of, okay, how then can you, all that learning that we've had from consumers and SMEs and businesses, how can we then take that to the corporates?
Fast track a couple of years at the same time, right? I don't have any more questions unscripted or scripted for you. So I do have one that we always finish on. So I've just actually lied to you. But one that we ask every guest is just, what is the one thing in fintech that you think is yet to happen?
I think what would be interesting is a...
That's what we're here for, interesting.
Good, I'm glad. what I think would be good is a super app, financial super app that's powered by open banking. So thinking about the WeChat of this world and actually how do you bring everything into that app through open banking. This isn't just the payment account open banking like UK open banking, but we're talking about data access here and how can we enrich all of those experiences through onboarding journeys, through being able to finance, being able to really drive the engagement that you have with consumers through this one application.
I'm certainly up for that. I think it's an overused term today, but a real possibility of tomorrow. Awesome. So any final thoughts? Give us a reminder of where people can find you, find out more about Tink, the stuff that you're doing, website, social channels, etc.
So you can connect with me on LinkedIn and you can find out more about Tink on our socials, so LinkedIn, Twitter. And then we've got our website as well, where you can find absolutely everything, including some really cool blogs and our research on tink.com.
Thanks very much. Thank you for spending the time with us today, Tash. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me.